Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, President Obama is facing problems on three fronts. He's dealing with the plane crash in Ukraine, the fighting between Israel and the Palestinians, and the crisis on the U.S. border with Mexico. In a few minutes, NPR's Ron Elving will join us from Washington to talk about all of it.
But first, the United Nations Security Council is calling for an immediate ceasefire between the Israelis and Palestinians as Secretary of State John Kerry makes another bid for peace in a trip to Cairo. After nearly 2 weeks of fighting, the Palestinian death toll tops 550, mostly civilians, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, and at least 27 Israelis have died so far, most of them soldiers. During an interview with the BBC's Arabic service, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended his decision to launch the ground offensive.
I regret, and the people of Israel regret, any civilian casualty. We target the rocketeers. We target Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists.
Today, Israeli forces shelled a hospital in Gaza, killing at least four and wounding at least 15. And for the second day in a row, neighborhoods in the east of Gaza City are also under attack. The BBC's Paul Adams has been out on the streets of Gaza and filed this report.
This is the Sha'af neighborhood, very close to Gaza City, and as you can hear, it's being rocketed absolutely continuously. These rockets are coming in closer and closer all the time. This neighborhood's being hit every few seconds. And you can see damage up the road here, and no people at all. Seems to have gone quiet now. We can still hear the drones overhead, and we've got to be ready for the possibility that shelling could start again. But we're not quite sure what the focus of Israeli activity is today just yet. This man here doesn't want to be identified, but he's got a piece here of shrapnel. That's from some kind of artillery round or rocket, the sort that have been coming in quite a lot in the last few minutes. Shukran.
It's terrible. We are sleeping on the floor. There is no food or drink. Our children are helpless. And the missiles keep falling all night.
The lady we were talking to just now, her story seems very typical. She was at home, she had to flee because of the shelling. She and her family sought shelter in one of the UN schools where people are flocking for safety. The UN says that around 80,000 or so people are now sheltering in about 44 of their schools. But the conditions there were really difficult, really overcrowded. There wasn't enough food and water. She tried to go back home to get supplies, but found that she couldn't get there safely. The situation was too difficult. And so you have a city where people are just moving this way and that, trying to find shelter, trying to find food, trying to find water, and never quite sure where to go.
The BBC's Paul Adams reporting from Gaza City.
And President Obama weighed in on the situation in Gaza this morning. He said he's dispatching Secretary of State John Kerry to the region to push for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
The work will not be easy. Obviously, there are enormous passions involved in this and some very difficult strategic issues involved. Nevertheless, I've asked John to do everything he can to help facilitate a cessation of hostilities. We don't want to see any more civilians getting killed.
Well, joining us for more is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. And Ron, lots to get to because we want to talk to you also about the plane crash in Ukraine and the diplomacy there and also what's happening along the border with Mexico. But first, let's get to Gaza. And Secretary of State was on some of the Sunday talk shows yesterday. And on Fox News Sunday, Chris Wallace, the host of that show, played a clip of Kerry on his cell phone with an open mic before the interview began. Here it is.
It's a hell of a pinpoint operation. It's a hell of a pinpoint operation.
Right. It's escalating for ceasefire.
We've got to get over there.
Nope.
Thank you, John. I think, John, we ought to go tonight. I think it's crazy to be sitting around.
And Ron Elving, he is going today to the region. But what can we glean from that moment accidentally caught on tape?
Jeremy, I think we can glean from that that the secretary has been disturbed at the rapid escalation of what had been advertised initially on the Israeli side as a pinpoint operation or as a very limited incursion, something along the lines of the last couple of times that the Israelis have gone into Gaza and tried to deal with, as Netanyahu calls them, the rocketeers, the people firing rockets into Israel's territory. But clearly, the goals here have grown, have expanded. Their focus really seems to be on the tunnelers, the people who are coming through these tunnels and into Israel and making strikes into the homeland that way from the Israeli standpoint. And that is perhaps as much or a greater, if not quite so visible, a concern for the Israeli people. And then finally, beyond that, there is a tremendous degree of impatience here among some of the elements of the Netanyahu cabinet and many people in the country, not all the people in the country, but many people really want to go in and deal with Hamas in some kind of permanent way, if permanent is a word that can be used in this part of the world. And that is perhaps the ultimate goal of this incursion, and the secretary is concerned about that.
Well, how much sway does the secretary have? Does the U.S. have right now in this region with Secretary Kerry going over there? Is he going to be able to get what he wants out of both sides?
It's instructive that he is not heading directly to Israel or to Gaza, for that matter. Not that one would expect him to go directly into the war zone, but it's instructive that he's heading for Cairo. It's a bit of a bank shot. We're going to the Egyptians. We're hoping that, as was the case in 2012 when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to meet with the Morsi government, that perhaps some kind of influence can be worked through the Egyptian government to influence Hamas and make them more willing to come to the table. Now, of course, you remember last week there was the offer of a ceasefire. There was a call for a ceasefire.
Yeah.
The Israelis said they were glad to have a ceasefire, but Hamas did not want to respond, at least not initially, and it's hard to find who the correct person is to talk to in Hamas in any given moment.
Mm. Ron, let's turn to the escalating politics surrounding the crash of the Malaysia Airlines flight in eastern Ukraine. John Kerry also speaking out about this yesterday. He was on NBC's Meet the Press, and he told David Gregory, host of that program, that he says there's powerful evidence that pro-Russian separatists did shoot the plane down. Let's listen.
There's a stacking up of evidence here, which Russia needs to help account for. We are not drawing the final conclusion here, but there is a lot that points at the need for Russia to be responsible.
President Obama also spoke about this once again today. Here's what he said.
These Russian-backed separatists are removing bodies from the crash site, oftentimes without the care that we would normally expect from a tragedy like this. And this is an insult to those who've lost loved ones. It's the kind of behavior that has no place in the community of nations.
Ron, he also talked about how those actions that he was discussing, he called them not decent. I'm just wondering how far President Obama can push the escalating rhetoric and what specifically he can ask, if anything, Russian President Vladimir Putin to do.
Specifically, he has asked Putin to insist, that's the word he used, that the separatists, whatever we want to call them in eastern Ukraine, the Russian sympathizers, the people who most of us assume are listening to Vladimir Putin, insist that they change their behavior, that they stop treating this crash site, this tragedy, as a kind of importuning of them, that in some sense or another they've been inconvenienced by it. They've been very quick to set up a line of security around it, and they have interfered with some of the investigators coming. They have interfered with some of the people coming to deal with the bodies. It's not clear what is going to happen to some of the bodies or what has already happened to some of them. And at the very minimum, without admitting the accusation of complicity or perhaps greater responsibility in what happened, that Putin could make representations to these people that they should cooperate more with the international organizations that are trying to deal with the tragedy.
But Ron, you are hearing the escalation in rhetoric even more from some of the Republicans in the United States. Here's Senator McCain, John McCain, speaking with Fox's Sean Hannity shortly after the plane was shot down.
It's just been cowardly. It's a cowardly administration that we've failed to give the Ukrainians weapons with which to defend themselves.
What's the politics of this? Are Republicans going to be with the president as he notches up the rhetoric against Russia, or are they pushing for him to do more? Or how is that going?
If we were to take John McCain at face value, Jeremy, I think we would have to say the Republicans would support greater weapons provision to the Ukraine government, to Kiev. And if that is going to be the next step, maybe not the next immediate step, but an eventual step supported perhaps by the Europeans, who still have to step up to the full economic sanction responsibility, if you will. If we expect that that will be the next step taken by the West, one would think that given the things that John McCain has been saying, John McCain would be with the president in supporting greater weaponry. And we have heard, for example, from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, still in the news very much, still in the political conversation very much, that she would support sending some greater assistance to Kiev. Now, what exactly that would consist of is not clear, and it is clear in the polls that most Americans do not want the United States to get more deeply involved in the military conflict in Ukraine.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Ron, and that is the crisis along the border in this country with Mexico and these tens of thousands of young people who have crossed the border illegally into the United States. It's a very difficult topic in Washington. President Obama has asked for a lot of money from Congress to help deal with this. Is there any chance that they're going to give him that before they leave town for the month of August?
Not the full $3.7 billion that the president has asked for, but it is possible that they will give some amount of money to deal with the immediate crisis of providing for these children and also for the judicial process that is supposed to take place before they return to their home countries or before they're allowed to stay in the United States. There is supposed to be a parsing of this under the law that was passed in 2008 that has been a magnet for many of these children to come here or for their parents to send them here. And that was a law that said that because of some of the sex trafficking that had been going on with children along the border, that children coming to the United States, not from Mexico or Canada, but from countries further down into Central America, were to be given special consideration in our usual immigration adjudication.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. And a program note, by the way, tomorrow on Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep will be talking more with Senator Marco Rubio about immigration. Tune in for that. Ron Elving, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you both.
In the early 1960s, President John F. Kennedy set the nation's sights on the moon. Half a century later, President Obama announced his moonshot to push science into the farthest reaches of the human brain.
You know, as humans, we can identify galaxies light years away. We can study particles smaller than an atom, but we still haven't unlocked the mystery of the 3 pounds of matter that sits between our ears.
And so the president committed an initial $100 million to a project called the Brain Initiative.
So there's this enormous mystery waiting to be unlocked. And the Brain Initiative will change that by giving scientists the tools they need to get a dynamic picture of the brain in action and better understand how we think and how we learn and how we remember.
Well, this week, we're featuring a series of reports called Brain Matters, reporting from the front lines of neuroscience. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WBUR's Carrie Goldberg begins with an overview of what some say could be the beginning of a golden age of brain science.
You could call this the sound of your brain at work. It's neurons firing in rhythm, talking to each other. These neurons belong to a crab and make up a simple circuit that controls how the crab chews and digests its food. It's something like what your neurons do to control your breathing.
But imagine now an orchestra with billions of neurons firing in different patterns depending on what you were seeing, what you were hearing, what you were thinking, and what you were feeling. Those rhythms would be changing in a tremendous symphony.
That's neuroscientist Eve Marder in her Brandeis University lab. She says making sense of that incredible complexity will be a lot harder than JFK's moonshot.
Unlike putting a man on the moon, where you knew exactly what the goal was and where the problem was largely an engineering problem, understanding the brain is going to require the coordination of creativity across every scientific discipline that we know.
But even if we give it everything we've got, can the human brain ever understand itself. That's the monumental gamble of President Obama's Brain Initiative and other major neuroscience efforts now getting underway around the world. But they're not trying to solve philosophical questions. They're responding to the growing realization that brain disorders, from autism to mental illness to dementia, are a worldwide scourge. They affect at least 1 billion people, says Tom Insel, director of the National Institute of Mental Health.
The global cost from brain disorders is about $2.5 trillion and will go up more than double over the next 2 decades. So we have got to begin investing to make sure we don't incur those kinds of costs.
Neuroscientists have been studying the brain for more than a century. What's different now is that for the first time, researchers say we're beginning to map the brain's billions of neurons and trillions of connections. We're starting to see how groups of neurons interact. That was out of reach even just a few years ago, and it's what we need if we ever hope to understand how we have a thought or a memory or a mental illness.
This is an exciting time to be a neuroscientist. I'm not sure there's ever been a more exciting time.
That's Larry Swanson, president of the Society for Neuroscience, speaking at its annual conference of about 30,000 scientists.
Scientists are advancing the field in ways that we were only, actually couldn't even imagine, say, 5-10 years ago.
At the conference in San Diego, government science officials touted the importance of an array of new tools for analyzing the brain, like the Brainbow, a technique that uses genetics and a rainbow of gorgeous fluorescent colors to map neurons. There's Clarity, a new chemical treatment to make brain tissue transparent. And there's the Connectome, an evolving map of the trillions of pathways that connect neurons to each other.
We might be in a golden age of making such tools, because most fields of engineering have not been applied to the brain. And so there's just a gold rush of possibility.
That's neuroengineer Ed Boyden. When he was in grad school over a decade ago, he was told not to bother trying to develop better tools for illuminating how the brain works. It was just too complex. Boyden now leads neuroengineering at MIT, and he's the co-creator of one of the hottest of these new technologies.
Optogenetics allows us to activate or shut down cells in the brain with light. If we can turn on cells in the brain, we can figure out what kinds of behaviors or diseases they contribute to. And by shutting off neurons, we can figure out what they're necessary for.
For example, researchers found a small cluster of cells in the mouse brain that, when activated with laser light, caused the mouse to behave so aggressively that it even attacked a rubber glove. There's a host of other methods in the new brain toolbox: stem cells, computer science for big data, better brain imaging, and there's DNA.
This is absolutely hot off the press genetic information.
Robert Desimone directs the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT.
We're talking about discoveries in just the last year or two. Genes for schizophrenia, bipolar disease, depression and so on, autism.
Desimone says the goal is to build a bridge from the gene to its effects on the brain to the disorder. Where might that bridge lead? Imagine I'm a psychiatrist of the future, and instead of just telling you that you have major depression, I say, we can turn some of your skin cells into specific brain cells, edit out the disease genes in those cells, and then implant them to fix your faulty circuit. For now, President Obama's Brain Initiative is developing tools to meet specific challenges. Last month, the Department of Defense announced a $30 million program based at Massachusetts General Hospital to try to build brain implants for veterans with post-traumatic stress and other disorders. One of the project's leaders, neurosurgeon Imad Eskandar, says the goal is a device about the size of a matchbox with electrodes that could detect patterns of pathological brain activity in real time.
When it detects those patterns, it then delivers stimulation to try and remedy that pattern of activity and restore it to something more normal. That's the basic idea.
Some neuroscientists point out that Obama's $100 million actually isn't very much, but it's a start. And it further reinforces the sense that we're at the dawn of a new era of the brain. Brain implants are just the beginning, Imad Eskandar says.
We're literally on the cusp of a complete revolution in both how we understand the brain and how we treat brain disorders.
So if we can fix brain disorders with implants, can normal brains be made better? Eskandar says at this point, that's just not the priority.
you know, we're really just trying to help the people who are suffering the most. It's not just the people, it's their families, it's their communities. These kind of disorders don't affect people in isolation. So that's really what this is all about.
For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And tomorrow, we'll take a look at how advances in brain imaging technology may help predict learning disorders like dyslexia even before children learn how to read.
Maybe the most surprising aspect of the research so far is how clear a signal we see in the brains of children who are likely to go on to be poor readers.
A Dutch disaster victims identification team arrived at a railway station near the crash site of Malaysia Air Flight 17 today, where rebels have stored more than 240 bodies in refrigerated wagons. This as fighting flared in the eastern Ukrainian region held by those pro-Russian separatists, underscoring the difficulties that investigators will have working in what amounts to a war zone. Jim Hall is the former chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board and current president of Hall Associates. He joins us from Washington. Jim Hall, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
So we were interested in hearing your perspective on this story because unlike a normal crash site, you know, ones you have had interactions with, this one is happening in a war zone. So what is not taking place in eastern Ukraine right now around the crash site that would have been taking place in a normal investigation?
Well, first let me just point out that the NTSB has on numerous occasions had investigators in war zones, so that on its face is not that unusual. But here, this is a rebel government, as I understand it. They have no formal accident investigation unit, and it's been very disappointing to me to see that the Russians have a very sophisticated safety board, very very similar to ours. I worked with them very closely in the 1990s, and for them not to step in and provide some assistance is really irresponsible. The way these human remains have been handled are just, it's just alarming.
Well, forgive the interruption there, but you were actually anticipating a question I was going to ask, which is there's so many concerns already over the integrity of evidence at the site, things being removed, human remains, personal belongings, etc. Is that going to compromise the quality of whatever investigation takes place overall, or really make it difficult for investigators to come to a conclusion that they could stand by when, as and when that happens?
Well, time will tell on that. You know, I think most of the information that you're going to need on this investigation will be with the black boxes and the ground-to-air and air-to-ground communications with air traffic control and with the military satellites that were covering that area. So the wreckage probably is not as important as it might be in other accidents, but not handling the human remains in a respectful way is a disrespect to everyone.
Mm. We're seeing that a leader of the pro-Russian rebels has agreed to hand over both black boxes from the flight to investigators who are in Ukraine, and that's according to Malaysia's prime minister today. Who would you, in the last couple seconds that we have, who is actually going to be in charge of an international effort when that takes place?
Well, I certainly hope the Dutch Safety Board will. The NTSB helped create the Dutch Safety Board. It's modeled after the NTSB. They're very capable. And Malaysia, as we saw from the previous accident, really doesn't have the capacity to do an investigation like this.
Jim Hall is the former chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. He's current president of Hall and Associates. He joined us today from Washington. Jim Hall, thank you so much for your perspective.
Thank you, Magna.
Foreign buyers have helped boost luxury real estate prices in places such as Manhattan and Los Angeles for several years now. But that trend may soon push into non-luxury markets across the United States. And one reason for that? Zillow, the popular real estate website, plans to publish its entire U.S. property database this summer in China in Mandarin. Diane Francis, a management professor at Ryerson University, has written about Zillow and Chinese buyers for The Washington Post and joins us from Toronto. Diane, welcome. And tell us first, why is Zillow doing this now?
Well, because the Chinese real estate buying market is the biggest game in the world right now.
Right. So what really captured my attention about Zillow's decision is that, you know, we have been seeing this trend of foreign and Chinese buyers in the ultra high end of the real estate market for some time. I mean, in your piece, you talk about Chinese parents who are buying multi-million dollar properties in New York for their children in case their kids go to Columbia or Harvard, and their children are like 2 or 3 years old right now.
I know. Bizarre.
So that has been happening for some time. But Zillow's database, it's got everything from the high end to the low end. So, I mean, are we likely to see an increase in Chinese buyers in, you know, sort of quote-unquote average residential markets?
It's at all levels of price point. So what basically Zillow is doing, and I have anecdotal and factual information in the U.S. about Chinese buyers buying land in Colorado, buying small bungalows in Houston. They're fanning out, and usually it's based on where the diaspora, because remember, there's about 3.5 to 4 million Chinese people from the mainland China living in the United States. And they like to settle where there's communities, speak their language, they can grocery shop, they can, you know, friends and relatives are, so they can get jobs more easily. So wherever there is a diaspora of any consequence, those would be the cities where they're targeting, and their relatives are encouraging them to come and join them.
Mm. So let's put this into context now, if we could. How large a percentage do Chinese buyers currently represent in the United States?
Let's just talk about the markets where they really concentrate right now. So in New York, for instance, in the condo side, I'm told they're between 40 and 50% of the condo buying, of the new condo buying in Manhattan. And that's the very high end. Then you go out to Brooklyn and other areas and environs, and it's pretty high. New York has always had about 10% foreign ownership of its co-ops and condos and townhouses, but that is going up now to about 15% in the last few years. So from 10 to 15% represents a 50% jump. And there's a lot of reasons driving this, and not the least of which is the environmental problems in China, the fact that many wealthy people exist there who want a better life, and the fact is they want their kids to go to school in the U.S. Plus, and I don't want to impugn everybody from China who buys in the United States, Canada, or Australia, but since 2012, there's been a crackdown on corruption. A lot of people have money they want to hide.
And I take your point. We're definitely not impugning all Chinese buyers or investors by any stretch of the imagination. But I am curious. I mean, are we talking, is this growth in Chinese investment in American real estate coming from investors who remain based in China, or is it because is there a burgeoning Chinese exodus of the middle class there coming to places like Canada, the United States, Australia?
I would say it's a bit of both, but generally speaking, a lot of the wealthier upper middle class Chinese people, not zillionaires, but they want their kids to get a Western education. And it's also a diversification. I mean, owning a U.S. property gives you property rights. Nobody's going to confiscate it. You can hide the money, but it's sort of like the new gold for them. U.S. dollar is strong. China is starting to slow down. The corruption is biting. The anti-corruption crackdown is biting. Lots of people are going to jail and being investigated. And that is aggravating a flight that's already hurting their economy.
How much can we expect the numbers of Chinese real estate buyers in the United States to grow? I mean, in your piece, you said that in 2014, some 100 million folks from China are expected to travel abroad. That doesn't necessarily mean they're all investing abroad, but their global exposure is growing.
I mean, everything about China has three extra zeros. And I think Toronto and Vancouver are kind of the canary in the mines. We have seen this huge spike in housing prices, a frenetic amount of buying. And now there's a whole industry set up to do this, to facilitate this. People may not even leave China. Their kids may not go to school, but they are now set up to deal with intermediaries who sell entire buildings. They buy 40 or 50 units in a high-rise condo in downtown Toronto or Vancouver near a university at a time, sight unseen. The parents will be buying it. It's also an investment.
So this is so fascinating to me on a number of levels. On one level, I mean, it makes sense that Chinese investors and middle-class or wealthy Chinese would see American real estate as a relatively safe place to put their money, let alone, you know, a potentially very positive investment if they're seeking to develop. You also note that in 2013, Chinese buyers snapped up $11 billion worth of property in the United States. But I'm curious. On the one hand, one could argue this is just an expression, a local expression of the global free market. The money flows where it wants and where it can. And right now the money's in China and it wants to flow into American real estate. That's the global perspective. But it's having a very distorting effect on local housing prices, is it not? I mean, what's the effect for the residents who actually are living in these places where housing prices are shooting through the roof?
It does distort. It is a problem. The Australians moved against it by prohibiting foreign buying on a speculative basis. People have to have a proper work permit or visa, and then they got to sell when they leave. I think that it's also aspirational. The Chinese are more like Americans than even the Canadians. They want to have a good way of life. They love America. They love New York City. They love LA. They love the movies. The number one show in China is House of Cards. They're fascinated. And so I see it as a very positive thing for the world in a way. But I would submit that China is going to have to somehow stop this because, first of all, they have currency controls. People are not supposed to be doing this to the extent that they are. Secondly, this is going to hurt their economy, and this is going to slow down their growth, which is going to create even more of a capital flight. So China, I would say, is going to start to crack down a little bit on this practice. However, it's going to continue anyway because the Chinese just want to get ahead.
Well, Diane Francis is editor-at-large at the National Post in Canada. She's also a management professor at Ryerson University in Toronto. Her article, "The Chinese Are Coming and They'd Like to Buy Your House," appeared in the Washington Post. Diane Francis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And there's a new book out about boxing by a former boxer named Springs Toledo. It's called The Gods of War, and it's filled with beautifully written essays about a sport that many consider anything but beautiful. I met up with Springs Toledo at The Ring, that's a boxing club in Boston. And before I talked with him, I had to ask some of the boxers there why they do it, starting with Richard Allen. I asked him how long he'd been boxing.
I've been boxing for 3 years.
And what is it that first got you interested in it?
My father was a boxer in the Navy, and I just felt like I should follow in his footsteps. He had me interested from a very young age. I started competing about 6 months into just boxing in general. I just have a lot of love for the sport in pretty much every facet.
And what is it that you get out of it on a daily basis when you do it?
Oh, what's not to love? You know, I come in here, a gym like this, it's not your normal gym, you know, it's like a small family, a community around here. So I come in here, I see the people I became close to, I work on my craft every day, I get to help people work on their craft, I get a lot of satisfaction out of seeing people succeed.
But are you getting out of it just exercise or aggression out, or are you preparing for a big fight, or what are you doing?
I'm getting ready for a fight in the fall. I fight in the Rocky Marciano tournament every September. Been in the championship 2 years consecutively. And we're going back to win it this year.
Helping Richie Allen along is trainer Rodney Tony, who's been at it a lot longer.
It's going on 26 years now.
Wow, 26 years. And what was it that first got you doing it?
Street fights. I used to fight on the streets a lot, you know, just raw neighborhoods and stuff like that. So from there, a lot of guys couldn't beat me in the neighborhood, so they had to have another alternative, which was guns, and I wasn't into that, so... So I went to a gym, talked to this guy. My father used to be a boxer a long time ago, too. So I went to him, and he took me to a gym. And then within 2 weeks, I was doing the Golden Gloves.
And has it evolved from street fights into something totally different now?
Totally different, yes, it has. It taught me how to be humble, too. You know, before I would attack somebody if they said anything wrong. Now I take my time, just try to talk to the guy out of it because you don't know what you're getting himself into, you know.
But does it put your head in a different space when you're boxing than when you're not?
When I'm boxing, I'm in a ring, I'm someone else. You know, I'm my character. My character is called the Punisher. That's my name. So when I go in the ring, I'm the Punisher. When I come out of the ring, I'm Rodney. You know, so inside the ring is different business than being outside the ring. Of course, I have to separate. It's like Bill Bixby with the Incredible Hulk, you know what I mean? Once he goes in there, it's different. When somebody insults him, he gets mad. That's how I used to be. But now I know how to control it and just do it in the ring.
Now, you do have a scar on your face above your eye. Is that a boxing injury?
Yes, it is. That's why I call it a $6,000 scar, you know, because the guy headbutted me in the fourth round. I kept fighting, but I didn't see how it was till the fight was over. Then I came and looked in the mirror like, oh, my God, they let me fight like this. You know, it's a terrible scar.
So why do you call it your $6,000 scar?
Because I got paid $6,000 on ESPN to fight the guy. So that's why it's a $6,000 scar.
It's a badge of honor now.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It was there. It happened on TV and everything, so it's there.
Trainer Rodney Tony and another fighter in the gym without a visible scar is Katie Weinberg, who told us she's relatively new to the sport.
2.5 years.
And what was it that first got you started doing it?
The boxing gym was closer than my other gym, so I came by one day.
Well, but something must have kept you here. What was it?
There's not that many sports you can pick up in your 30s that you actually can do a decent job at, I think. And I've got a little bit of power, and I felt like I was doing okay. So it's more interesting than a treadmill. And you got some characters here, so.
But you talk to some of these characters here, and a lot of them have a background in street fighting or anything like that. Do you have that?
No, I would say probably the opposite of that. But I'm actually vegetarian, and I literally won't hurt a fly, but I guess that emotion has to come out somewhere, doesn't it?
You're not worried about being injured?
Well, I think my parents are worried about me being injured. But I had a bruised kidney and a couple black eyes, but it's kind of like a badge of pride, I guess, right?
But now you're okay.
I hope so. Maybe some internal injury. I keep forgetting my keys places, so maybe I have been hit in the head one too many times.
Amateur boxer Katie Weinberg. So, back to the book that brought us here in the first place. The man who wrote it, Springs Toledo, is a kind of legend here at the ring, in part because he's been boxing for a long time.
I'm from actually the same neighborhood as Rodney, and we grew up basically fighting, and I was a pretty gentle kid, and I was on the receiving end of a lot of beatings. And I met him. I was about 12 years old and learned how to box, and it gave me something to hold on to. Made me feel more comfortable in my own skin, made me feel like I had some self-respect. So it really was a gift. And when I got a little older, I kind of switched into writing. So now instead of being a brawler, I try to be a scholar, so to speak.
And you really do romanticize boxing and your love of it. I want you to read a little bit, if you could, from this section of the book here. Let's see, page 33 from your book.
Without really being conscious of it, we boxing fans are on sabbatical from a modern culture gone mad with political correctness. We lose ourselves in a celebration of ancient virtues of masculinity. Need evidence? Watch the crowd as the bell rings to end a blazing round, and you'll see graying men jump up and down like pogo sticks. Sometimes you'll see two strangers locked in an embrace, their heads craned toward the ring. Boxing can bring an almost spiritual exaltation.
And in this book also, you compare boxing and the fight that is going on to war. Really, you take it to another level.
There's a lot at stake in the ring. Now, the term war, it's a little poetic license there, of course, but some fights, if you've seen them, for instance, Hagler-Hearns from 1985, is still talked about in Boston. That's a war, and it's very, very personal. Although at the end of the fight, which you'll notice in boxing, more than most other sports, where after a good contest, the participants will shake hands. In boxing, they embrace. And it's not a bro hug. It's a real embrace. Because the only one who knows what you went through is your opponent. So in some ways, it is a war. But it's also something beautiful in its own way.
You can imagine there are a lot of listeners who are saying to themselves, I don't think there's anything beautiful about it. It's terrible. It's a fight. And actually, it can be quite dangerous for the people doing it.
I don't deny that. Boxing's the toughest sport there is. And there is danger involved. I look at the glory side of that as well. And the danger in it can be mitigated if you have a good trainer.
Wherever you go now, will you find boxing alive and well in this country, or will you find boxing really on the decline or a shadow of its former self?
Boxing has been lamented as being on the decline since probably the 1940s, when the clubs started to close down and TV started to come in. The old trainers said it's not like it used to be. You know, the golden days will always be the golden days. Boxing, though, is not a mainstream sport like it used to be. It used to be as big as baseball and horse racing in the 30s and in the 40s. It was a huge sport, front page news. Now, not so much. But boxing as a sport, in some ways, it's opened its gates. You know, 20 years ago, when I was at the Boston YMCA, no one would come into that gym except for fighters. Females never came in. Even guys who lifted weights down the hall, they weren't eager to come in. Civilians, we called them, did not go into that gym. However, this gym, now most, if not half, of the clientele are females.
And why do you think that is?
I think that the owners, gym owners and things like that, they realize that they're not going to survive if they keep it as a brotherhood. So what they did is they expanded out. They marketed it better. Boxing workouts are virtually unchanged in 100 years, but they're very effective.
Well, Springs Toledo, author of The Gods of War, some really beautiful writing about boxing. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you very much.